welcome.
Shalom, and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by OU Israel. I'm your host, Phil Chernovsky. This show is for Shabbat Parshat Bo. Today, first recording and first broadcast of the show, is Yom Chamishi, Vav Shvat, Tovshin Samach Zayin, Thursday, the sixth day of Shvat, 5767, Thursday, January 25th, which is my middle daughter's birthday, her secular calendar birthday. We observe both. Actually, you'll hear as part of the talk on the setting up of the Jewish calendar, I think that every Jew should know his Hebrew birthday for sure. And the fact that he grows up with a secular birthday in many countries, there's no reason to deny that. So if you do what we do in the house, that is observe a child's birthday or anybody's birthday from their Hebrew to their English date or from English to Hebrew, you find that sometimes you don't have a birthday, you have a birth period, an anniversary period of your birth, which could span 3 weeks, maybe as much as a month sometimes, sometimes only a couple of days, sometimes 1 day, 2 days. Turns out with my middle daughter Aviva, she was born on January 25th, the eve of the 8th of Shvat, on a Friday night of Parshat Bo. So this Shabbat, this is the 8th of Shvat. It's also Parshat Bo. So that's much more emotional for us in remembering back to her birth, but the 25th is the 25th, so it turns out that I not only was able to wish her a happy birthday today, and again in Yirtzeh Hashem on Shabbat, but I have wished her in the printed version of Torah Tidbits a happy between birthdays, which runs from 12 a.m. Friday morning until about 5:30 p.m., so for that number of hours, what's that, about 17 hours, 17 and a half hours, she'll be between birthdays, but that's how it goes. It's a lot of fun. As far as this show, I have a shiur that I gave yesterday to the Torah Tidbits folders, another one with a different topic, although an overlapping topic, as you will hear, that I gave a couple of minutes ago. And together it will be a good picture, I think, of Parshat Bo. Again, I have to say that I'm not looking just to get out of the extra broadcasting, but I consider the Torah Tidbits folders when I sit around the tables downstairs with them to be part of the audience of Torah Tidbits Audio. They're sitting there physically folding the hard copy of Torah Tidbits, listening to me giving them a shear, and that's like Torah Tidbits Audio, and so is this. So I actually told them in today's shiur that they shouldn't think as if I'm recording the shiur and then I'm going to broadcast it on the radio show, but rather the shiur was for the radio listening audience, and I was letting them listen to it before that happened, which of course is the same thing, but I wanted it to sound different. In any event, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir ha-ma'alot mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihiena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmarya Adonai mi ya'amod, ki imecha haslicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro ho'cholti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'boker, shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut, v'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara v'ashivya ha-omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha-makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha ובאפלה אורה ובשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב, ונאמר אמן. In addition to acknowledging my daughter's birthday today and Shabbat, I'd like to wish a happy birthday to my niece, Bryna, and to my soon-to-be future son-in-law, actually he's already my future son-in-law, my soon-to-be son-in-law, Noam, for their birthdays this week as well.
I have a difficult time with Parshat Bo not speaking about Kiddush HaChodesh, because it's sort of my all-time favorite, for a lot of reasons which I won't go into now. But I want to focus on the details that will show you how truly amazing the mitzvah that was given by God to Bnei Yisrael to set up the calendar really is. Let's start first with a quick detail. The mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh involves Sanhedrin. We don't have one today. I'm not discussing what happens when there's no Sanhedrin. A Sanhedrin, which has a committee of 3, 5, or 7 judges, I don't really remember which, I think there's a dispute, who calculate by the scientific knowledge of when the moon will first be visible after a period of invisibility. They calculate when it's visible, and when it is, they wait for witnesses to come to testify that they saw the lunar crescent, the first visibility of the lunar crescent. Knowledge of its visibility is not enough. It has to be eyewitness testimony. That really has to be qualified, that statement, but I won't now take it lightly at the moment. Sanhedrin knows for sure the moon will be visible at a certain evening. It's not enough, based on that knowledge, to sanctify the month. They have to wait for eyewitness testimony. Witnesses come, they are received and questioned by the committee, and they tell the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, that they have accepted at least 2 valid witnesses, and based on that testimony, the Nasi appears in public in the courtyard of the Sanhedrin right after sunrise the following morning, and proclaims the day as holy. That's Kiddush HaChodesh. God sanctifies time, proof of which is Shabbat. Al Kain, God created in 6 days the heavens and the earth and everything in it. Al Kain, Beirach Hashem et Yom HaShabbat. Therefore, God blessed Shabbat, Vayikadshehu, and He sanctified it. Not only can God sanctify time, but He gave over to us the ability to sanctify time, which is HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, Rosh Chodashim, Rishon Hu Lachem, it's yours. Ela Moadei Hashem Asher Tikru'u Otam, that you declare. The holidays and Rosh Chodesh are Kodesh, not because God sanctified them, but because we sanctify them. How far does this go? Here's a halacha in the Rambam. Rambam Hilchot Kiddush HaChodesh. Beit Din Shekidshu Et HaChodesh, a court that sanctifies the month. Bain shogegin, bain mutain, bain anusim. If they made a mistake by accident, negligently, they were deceived, they were confused, whatever. Harezem mekudash. What they declared as Rosh Chodesh is Kodesh. V'chayavin hakol l'taken hamoadot al hayom shekidshubo. And every Jew is obligated to fix the holiday of that month based on their mistaken sanctification. Afal pi sheze yodea sheta'u, even though you know they made a mistake, chayav lismoch aleihem, you must rely on them. She'ein hadavar masur ela lahem. The chore, the task, not the chore, the task of Kiddush HaChodesh belongs to the Sanhedrin. Not to you, and not even to God. Umi she'tziva lishmor ha-moadot, he, capital H, who commanded us to observe the holidays, hu tziva lismoch aleihem, he was the one that commanded us to rely on them. She'nehemar asher tikru'u otam, as it says, the holidays which you declare, not which I tell you to do, the ones that you declare. Rosh Chodesh should be when the moon begins its cycle. The beginning of the cycle is defined as when the moon is in between the earth and the sun. And then it continues to travel in a full circle back to that spot again. Moshe Rabbeinu, the first Sanhedrin-like individual, he and Aharon, challenged God when God said to them, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim, when God said, this is how you should start your month, Moshe Rabbeinu said, I can't see the moon then. It's not visible. God said, okay, you will wait until you are able to see it. That means that not only what I read in the Rambam, that there's a provision for what happens when Sanhedrin makes a mistake, that we still have to follow it, but we always make a mistake. We're always late when we have a Sanhedrin. We're always later than it really should have been, because God wants us to see it, and we are not capable of seeing it at that earlier time. So already built in to this is God saying, I sanctified Shabbat. All you have to do with Shabbat is acknowledge that sanctity by making Kiddush when it enters and Havdalah when it leaves. And of course, you have to observe Shabbat and keep the rules. But you don't make Shabbat holy. God does. When God gave over to us the ability to make Rosh Chodesh holy, He made several concessions towards us, first by saying that we'll wait until you're capable of seeing it. And then he said that if you happen to make a mistake, we're going to keep it anyway. Now there's more. When, still talking about the time of Sanhedrin, when witnesses see the first visibility of the lunar crescent on a Friday night, they have halachic permission, actually it's more than permission, they have a requirement to travel to Yerushalayim to testify, even though it will involve what otherwise would be Chilul Shabbat, desecration of the Shabbat. Now what's astounding about that is, first of all, Shabbat has a higher level of Kedusha than Yom Tov, which is based on Rosh Chodesh, and certainly than Yom Tov. So in Rosh Chodesh. So in order to sanctify Rosh Chodesh, God allows us to violate that day which has a higher Kedusha in order to go and testify. More, the testimony of Rosh Chodesh is unique among all testimonies. I mean by that, that testimony is usually presenting to a court that which you know, which nobody else knows. Here are two people that come before a court. Reuven says, Shimon owes me 1,000 shekel. I lent it to him and he never paid me back. Shimon says, I don't know what this guy's talking about. I never borrowed any money from him. The court will turn to Reuven and say, look, we don't know what's true. You say you lent him 1,000 and he didn't pay it back. He says he never borrowed. Burden of proof is on you. Do you have a document, a signed document? No, it was a gentleman's agreement. Okay, do you have witnesses? Yes, I do. Now, these witnesses are going to testify before a court to something that the court does not know. The court does not know if Reuven lent 1,000 shekel to Shimon or not. All they have is Reuven's word and Shimon's contradictory word, and that's not enough. They need proof. One of the proofs is kosher witnesses testifying to facts that they are missing, and that makes the testimony important. But Kiddush HaChodesh is the opposite. Kiddush HaChodesh, the court is required to know in advance exactly when the moon is visible, where in the sky it's visible, for how long it's visible, which way it's leaning, how big is the piece of light that it is that evening, and it has to know all of that information in order to question intelligently the witnesses, who sometimes are not even sure. They come and they say, we think we saw the Levana v'chidusha. We think we saw the first visibility of the lunar crescent. Very difficult to see. So it was cloudy, the clouds parted, and we saw a piece of light. It was in sort of the right part of the sky. We think we saw the Kiddush HaChodesh, the Levana v'chidusha. The court will tell them, no, you didn't, because the direction that you claim to have seen it in, it's not visible there. Or the court will say, very likely that you did see it because you've described it exactly the way it is. In other words, witnesses are coming to testify before a court, not for what the court doesn't know, for what the court knows better than the witnesses do. And yet, the testimony is required, and yet, it can be done on Shabbos, even if it means traveling from Tzfat to Yerushalayim on a Friday night. That, to me, boggles the mind. But I can understand it only if you see it as God wanting, kivyochol, our active participation in the process, because our involvement is very crucial since the holiday cycle is us. Shabbat was God, remember that. God created the world and rested on the seventh day, and he created the sanctity of Shabbat. But we were slaves to Paro in Egypt, and we came out of Egypt, and we stood at Har Sinai and received the Torah, and we lived in Sukkot of one sort or another, heavenly clouds of glory, or actual Sukkot during the period of the Midbar, and we were involved in the process of asking for forgiveness and getting atonement, and we acknowledge God as the king on Rosh Hashanah. I don't know if that fits in so well, but leave it. And therefore God said, I'm not going to do this for you. You're going to do it. Obviously, God is involved. He's the one that sent the moon around the earth. And all we're doing is watching it, but it needs that active participation. And God says, I consider it so important that I will allow my Shabbat to step aside so that you could testify. Now, there's only one other thing that allows violation of Shabbat. Pikuach nefesh. Life-threatening situation. And therefore, I like to see this as something which I call a national life-threatening situation. It threatens the national character of the Jewish people because its character is based upon God appearing to Moshe and Aaron in Mitzrayim before we got out and saying to them, HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim. To me, that's how important it is. Now, in a very mundane application of this, if you get as excited as I do, or close to it, about the concept, then here's your way, our way, of plugging into it. We cannot, at this moment, sit on a Sanhedrin and accept witnesses or testify before a Sanhedrin or do Kiddush HaChodesh, because we don't have a Sanhedrin. But what can you do? One example. When you write a check today, don't write the 24th of January, 07. Write the 5th of Shvat, 5767. In this country, it is 100% acceptable to write to the Jewish calendar. And I know what you're going to say. I know it's the 24th of January, but I didn't know that it was the 5th of Shvat. It's not an easy thing, but I'll tell you, for 25 years, I have written every single check that I've ever written with the Jewish date.
I agree for over 60 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow.
You can't do it that long.
No, but I've done it for 25 years, and I hope to do it for 60 years.
Right.
But every time I do it, I smile in my heart, and I say, I don't say it every time, but it's like saying, L'shem mitzvah Kiddush HaChodesh, because that's the way we sanctify the month, in such a mundane way. I love going into stores in Mea Shearim and Geula, from people behind the counter. They write a receipt, 24/1/07. I go, he goes, ma. I said, Tarich kaze, ben adam kamocha, Yehudi kamocha, takotev kacha. Atatzodek. You're right. Aval malasot. Mas hachnasa insists on it. I said, no, it doesn't. It doesn't insist on it. You could write the Jewish date. So, I'm glad to report, and I'll say who it is, because it's the opposite of Lashon Hara, Lashon HaTov. Glick. Paper on Rehov HaChavatzelet, where we order paper from very often. I went through this whole thing with one of the guys there, Yossi, and the next time I came in, he proudly showed me his receipt book. He said, look at those dates. And they were all with the Jewish date. And this is years already that he's doing that. And he said, you shamed me into it.
As E.G. Marshall used to say on Radio Mystery Theater,
I shall return shortly with Act Two.
You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio. I have an offer to make, speaking of the Jewish calendar. If there is any listener that does not know his Jewish birth date, or bar mitzvah sedra, or, on the other side of the life, a yahrzeit, anniversary of someone's death, by all means, there are programs that are available for you to download on the internet, but you can also send a request to TTA, at OUIsrael.org, O-R-G, T-T-A, as in Torah Tidbits Audio, at OUIsrael.org. Ask, and I will be glad to supply you with that information. You need to tell me the date you are looking for, including the year, of course, and preferably the time of day. If it's really close to that time, the location is important as well. In other words, a baby born in London and another one in New York or in Jerusalem at exactly the same moment can have two different Hebrew birthdays, depending on whether the sun had already set in one place and not yet set in another, etc., etc. So send that and I'll be glad to supply the information and or tell you how you can download one of these programs on your own. In addition, another offer, if you would like me to acknowledge somebody's birthday, Jewish calendar, general calendar, or whatever, or a memorial, I'll be glad to do it on the show. Remember the email address, tta@ouisrael.org.
If it were not for the act of Sanhedrin that proclaims Rosh Chodesh Nisan as holy, then 15 days later, 2 weeks later, the 15th of Nisan would not be Yom Tov, would not be Pesach. You would be allowed to eat chametz on that day. You would not have a mitzvah to eat matzah. Gone. It doesn't exist. To me, that's the sharpest way to emphasize that it is the act of the Jewish people in declaring Rosh Chodesh Nisan that creates the halachic obligations of the mitzvot and prohibitions 2 weeks later of Pesach. It's a mind-boggling thing. You have to add to that, chas v'chalila, if it happened that they didn't do it. Because they've always done it. And then, of course, the second question that follows immediately is, what about today? What Sanhedrin declares the first day of Nisan as holy to make Pesach? The answer is, it's been done by a Sanhedrin. I explain it not in an accurately historical way, but in a way that I can understand. Picture a Sanhedrin of old writing a secret document containing the method of calculation of the calendar when there is no Sanhedrin. I picture a Sanhedrin sealing this document with a note to be opened if and when there will not be a Sanhedrin. And that contains the instructions as to how to set up the calendar. More than that, that's not enough. More than that, that Sanhedrin used its authority to sanctify every month that is calculated based on the calculations for as long as it will be necessary to do until a new Sanhedrin takes over. Got that? The other thing that you have to understand is that today we cannot use the alternative, or cannot use the original, let's say. We must use Plan B. It's not your choice. I read to you yesterday the Rambam's halacha, not even like this. To me, it's even more astonishing that when a mistake is done, a mistake is made. The mistake was they proclaimed in the time of Sanhedrin Rosh Chodesh on a certain day, and it was wrong. And they know it's wrong, and everyone else knows it's wrong. You still stick with what they say. God, kivyachol, so to speak, changes his calendar to match B'nai Israel. There's a famous story, Medrash, whatever, of angels coming to God and asking, when is the upcoming Rosh Hashanah? God says, what are you asking me for? Check with the Sanhedrin. They'll tell you, I can't. So, whatever that means, and however accurate that story is, take it as a reminder of the power of Beit Din. The famous story from the Gemara of Rabban Gamliel having proclaimed Rosh Chodesh on a certain day, based on dubious witnesses, let's call them. The reason I call them dubious is the Gemara says what they testified to was that this morning, shortly before dawn, we saw the last lunar crescent of the previous month, and tonight, right after sunset, we saw the Levana b'chidusha, the moon in its newness. Rabban Gamliel accepted that testimony based on the fact that according to his mathematical calculations, the moon could have been visible that night, and the witnesses testified that they saw it, and that part of their testimony was accurate. Rabbi Yehoshua, who was the Av Beit Din, the second in command to the Nasi, challenged the testimony because of the first part of the testimony, which was early this morning, we saw the last crescent of the previous month. Rabbi Yehoshua says that is a physical impossibility. Rambam states it clearly also. And check with astronomers, it is never, ever, ever possible to see a piece of the old moon early in the morning and a piece of the new moon later that night. There's got to be at least one day if not 2 days, of invisibility. It's just the way nature is. So Rabbi Yehoshua said, we can't accept their testimony, and they were the only witnesses, we can't accept their testimony because they obviously, there's a flaw and inaccuracy in their testimony. Rabbi Gamliel argued, it doesn't matter what they said about seeing the moon early in the morning, because I didn't ask them. They didn't have to say anything about it. It's not part of the questions. It's not part of testimony. It's like an extraneous piece of you know, whenever you see the law shows on television, the witness will ramble on, and the judge will say, confine yourself to answering the questions as asked, or one of the attorneys will object. This was something they didn't have to say, they shouldn't have said, and it doesn't mean anything. Turns out that Rabbi Yehoshua was right. It was not supposed to be that testimony accepted. There was a mistake that was made. And he said, I know what the real thing was. So he told people that Rabbi Gamliel had made a mistake. And he was planning, this was the month of Tishrei, he was planning Yom Kippur to observe the 10th day based on what he considered to be the correct day of Rosh Chodesh, Rosh Chodesh Tishrei. Rabbi Gamliel said, what a Beit Din does, even if they're wrong, stands. And therefore, Rosh Chodesh is then, when I said so, that's Rosh Hashanah, 10 days is Yom Kippur. That was the day before Rabbi Yehoshua's suggested day for Yom Kippur. Now, it doesn't say, and I suspect that Rabbi Yehoshua was going to observe the regular day, the one based on the pronouncement of Sanhedrin, as well as being machmir on the following day, because he in his heart knew that was correct. Rabbi Gamliel got wind of this, and he said in front of everyone in the Sanhedrin, Rabbi Yehoshua, I understand that you disagreed with my accepting that testimony, and such a person told me. Rabbi Yehoshua could not deny it. Rabbi Gamliel had him stand, which you do when you address the Nasi, and he did not tell him he was allowed to sit down. This resulted, by the way, but that's another part of the Gemara, to Rabbi Gamliel's being removed as the Nasi for a period of time because of the way he treated Rabbi Yehoshua. But that's not the point. Rabbi Gamliel said, not only does my Yom Kippur, so to speak, stand, but I order you to appear in public with your walking stick and your money pouch on the day that you claim should have been a Yom Kippur. Rabbi Yehoshua was devastated by that, and he didn't know what to do. You can't defy the Nasi, but this is what he believed was Yom Kippur, where it would be usher to do what he did. It would be today the equivalent of saying to him, I expect to see you eating an ice cream, you know, on the day that you claim is is Yom Kippur. So Rabbi Akiva, I think, was the one who appeased Rabbi Yehoshua. I went to visit him, and he was really distraught. He didn't know what to do. Rabbi Akiva convinced him that the power of the Nesi'ut has to be maintained, the authority. Ki mitzion teitzei Torah udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. There is no way to get around that it can't be weakened. And Rabbi Yehoshua accepted that he appeared in public with his money pouch, to which the Gemara says Rabbi Gamliel kissed him on his head and said, you are my Rebbe and my student. My student because you accepted my psak, and my Rebbe because you have taught me a lesson in the integrity of the court. I might be mixing up three stories from the Gemara, but basically that's it. It's a very powerful thing. And it also makes the point of saying we might have I was going to say inaccurate, it's not. It's a different accurate calendar, but this is the calendar that's the real one. Unlike Lahavdil, the Karaites who don't who observe their Pesach sometimes in our second Adar, because they don't accept the method of declaring a day as a year as Rosh Chodesh, rather. It's an important point about rabbinic authority that we could learn from to this day. Now, to be fair, there are 20 mitzvot out of 613. This is our first big influx for the year. And there is no doubt that it's Pesach that wins the case. There are 9 out of these 20 that deal directly with Korban Pesach. And most all the others, in some way, are connected to the story of the Exodus. Let's at least list them and see things that you get out of the fact that they exist. Aside from Kiddush HaChodesh, which we've spent a lot of time talking about, there's the mitzvah of Shechitat HaPesach, which means, aside from the mitzvah of eating Korban Pesach, there's the mitzvah to bring Korban Pesach. Shechitat HaPesach is its own mitzvah. Achilat Besar HaPesach is a mitzvah separately. There is a prohibition of eating Korban Pesach either raw, rare, or cooked. The point really is that the Torah says it is to be eaten tzli esh, roasted on an open fire, and that is the only way it's allowed to be prepared and eaten. You're not allowed to eat the meat of Korban Pesach that's cooked. I'll show you how far that goes. The Mishnah says that the skewer, the spit, upon which the Korban Pesach was roasted had to be made from the branch of a pomegranate tree, not a metal rod, and not other trees. The reason for no metal rod is that the rod would heat up from the fire, and the piece of meat in contact with the rod would get broiled, or whatever you want to call it, scorched, from the heat of the rod, and that's not tzliyesh, which means you wouldn't be allowed to eat that part that came into contact with the rod. So you'd have to cut it away. So instead of that, they say, don't use something that can heat up and do cooking. They use the pomegranate because it does not produce moisture when heated, which would constitute cooking and also make it invalid. Two of the reasons for the method of tzli esh as opposed to cooking. One is it is the tastiest method of preparing it and the least economical. You cook a piece of meat, it retains its juices and even produces juices which you can then serve with the meat. And it doesn't shrink. The idea of it being tasty, fresh roasted lamb, and losing a lot of its liquid with dripping away, which contributes to its being tasty, and making it less practical for whom? For a poor person. A poor person will prepare his meat if he's got it in such a way that he'll have leftovers for the next day. Next prohibition. You're not allowed to leave over any of Korban Pesach for the next morning. You've got to finish it up. And anything that's left over, ba'esh tisrofu, has to be burned in a fire. And you don't break a bone in Korban Pesach, and part of that reason is it gets the most out of it, which, again, economically-minded people want to do. They want to be able to have meat now, leftovers for tomorrow, chew and nutschki, as they say, or whatever other term you use, for the marrow and the bone the day after, and make a soup out of it or a stew out of it and stuff like that. And all of that goes against the symbol of nobility and freedom that Korban Pesach is meant to represent. Also, roasting is faster than cooking. And on the night of Korban Pesach, that was a requirement to be eaten in haste, the chipazon. And even though that's not a requirement in future Pesachs, it still is a symbol of not only the luxury and nobility to which B'nai Israel was free to enter, but it also was a symbol of the haste with which they came out of Egypt, which relates it to matzah. Okay, so far we had Shechitat HaPesach, slaughtering the Korban Pesach and offering it, eating the Korban Pesach, not eating it raw, not leaving over any for the morning. Skipping a little ahead in the Sedra, you're not allowed to feed meat of the Korban Pesach to a Jew who has turned his back on Judaism. And I'm not talking about a non-religious person, I'm talking about a person who has embraced another religion, a Mishuman. Nor to a non-Jew, nor to an uncircumcised. Not allowed to break a bone, I mentioned. So those are some of the mitzvot that relate to the actual Korban Pesach. Then you have the eating of matzah, the getting rid of chametz from your possession, the not possessing of Korban Pesach, of chametz, the non-possession of chametz mixtures, deriving benefit from chametz. These are all spelled out, and they all obviously relate to Yetziat Mitzrayim, to the Exodus. Now, you also have a couple of mitzvot that relate to the sanctity of a bechor, a firstborn. Some are in here, in Parshat Bo, others are elsewhere in the Torah. All are related to Yetziat Mitzrayim. Even though there was a concept of bechor before this, the concept of bechor took on a new special meaning with our being spared Makat Bechorot, the plague of the killing of the firstborns of the Egyptians. And in that wake, you've got the sanctity of firstborn of human, firstborn of a kosher domesticated animal, and a firstborn of a donkey. The only one that's spelled out in Parshat Bo is the donkey, called Peter Chamor. And the other Bechors, that of a kosher domesticated animal, that's in Parshat Bechukotai, I think, and the firstborn of a human is more detailed in Parshat Korach. But all three get their sanctity from the same source. The treatment of them is obviously different in halacha. A firstborn human has to be redeemed, and there are exceptions of which ones don't require, etc., etc. The firstborn of a kosher domesticated animal is brought as a korban, given as a gift to a kohen and brought as a korban. The firstborn of a donkey must be redeemed by giving a sheep or the monetary value of sheep to a kohen of your choice, and then the donkey is free and clear for the owner to use as he would any other animal that he owns. And if not, the Torah says he must destroy the donkey. If a donkey raiser, owner, has a female donkey who gives birth to her first offspring and it's a boy, that baby donkey requires pidyon peter chamor, redemption of a firstborn donkey. If for some reason, for any reason, the owner refuses to do that, he says, I don't want to give a sheep, I'd rather have a sheep than this little baby donkey, then the baby donkey has to be destroyed. And even though you showed me your feeling about that with your lower lip protruding, which, of course, those people who are going to hear this on Israel National Radio or OU Radio cannot see the protruded lip. That's why I'm describing it. By the way, what I should have said before, I'll get back to this in a moment, is that very often I tape part of the shiur here and I put it onto the radio show. On the radio show, I explained to the people listening that I had just given a shiur to the folders and it's also being broadcast. Here I want to do the opposite. Here I am broadcasting this shiur, and I will give it to the listeners earlier than the broadcast. Instead of recording it at the shiur and giving it later on the radio, I'm giving it on the radio later this afternoon, and earlier than that, I am letting you listen to the recording, but since the recording isn't made yet, you're hearing it from my voice. If that makes sense to you, that would really, really be a terrific thing. It is clear, and I keep writing it whenever I write about Pidyon Peter Chamor, that these are not two equal alternative mitzvot. It's not like you have a new donkey, Mazel Tov, here's your choice. You could redeem the donkey in the process of giving a kohen a sheep and making the bracha, etc., etc., or you could destroy the donkey. Those are not equal choices. If you refuse to do it, you have to know that that donkey is forbidden to derive any benefit from, and you're really doing the wrong thing by not performing Pinyon Peter Chamor. Ad kedei kach, that the Torah requires you to destroy the donkey to nobody's benefit, including your own. And I believe that's supposed to wake up the person to say, I really should do the proper thing and redeem this donkey like I'm supposed to, even though it's going to cost me the cost of a sheep. How much are sheep today? I don't know. You know, but.
Okay, here's a problem. We're just about out of time for Torah Tidbits Audio this week. As usual, a lot more to say, less time to say it in. But Amir Tzashem, we'll get to it sometime in the future. Until then, as E.G. Marshall used to say, well, he didn't say this, but until then, Shabbat Shalom and Lehishtameah.